Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Episode Forward Thinkers. Mein Name ist Daniel Fürk und mein heutiger Gast ist Douglas Rushkoff. Der amerikanische Medientheoretiker, Autor und Kritiker der Tech-Industrie beschäftigt sich seit vielen, vielen Jahren mit den gesellschaftlichen Auswirkungen digitaler Technologien. In seinen Büchern und Vorträgen warnt er eindringlich vor der zunehmenden algorithmischen Steuerung unseres Denkens und vor der Macht jener, die diese Systeme kontrollieren. Ich wollte von ihm wissen, warum unsere Gesellschaft so anfällig für digitale Manipulation geworden ist, wie technologische Eliten unsere Vorstellung von Zukunft prägen und was wir tun können, um unsere Resilienz als Menschen und Gemeinschaften zurückzugewinnen. Ich habe ihn im Rahmen des DLD Future Hubs in München getroffen und wollte von ihm wissen, warum unsere Gesellschaft so anfällig für digitale Manipulation geworden ist, wie technologische Eliten unsere Vorstellung von Zukunft prägen und was wir tun können, um unsere Resilienz als Menschen und Gemeinschaften zurückzugewinnen. Wenn dir diese Episode von Forward Thinkers gefällt, folge uns bei Spotify, Apple Podcasts oder wo auch immer du gerne Podcasts hörst und hinterlasse uns eine gute Bewertung.
In an ever-changing world, we need to keep track of what will be next. Forward Thinkers is your 48 Forward podcast to discover the future. We are talking to innovative and creative minds from all over the world to learn more about what they are working on and what they think will change the way we work and live within the next decade. Are you ready to join the ride? Welcome to Forward Thinkers.
Douglas, I'm so happy that we are able to meet here during DLD in Munich to talk a little bit about how media is changing, how our view on the world might be changing through feeds and algorithms and everything, and what kind of influence all those tech guys behind all of those technologies might have on our future. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We are living in a crazy time, I would say. Like, we've got war, we had a pandemic. It's like, you know, there's so much going on or has been going on over the last couple of years. And in the middle of that, media is changing a lot. Like, in former times, we had like a couple of publishing companies. They kind of have been in control of most of what we actually saw, of most of what was visible, of kind of directing how we see the world. And now we've got social media, we've got feeds, we've got algorithms that actually dictate how visible a topic is becoming or an opinion. And everything is becoming more, and at the same time, maybe even more streamlined, because we are all trying to get as much reach as possible and trying to influence those algorithms as good as we can to actually make visible what we are putting out there. How dangerous is this whole thing?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're saying in some ways the media was always controlled by companies, and now the media is controlled by companies. You know, so I don't see much difference, I guess, you know, except the style through which the cultural narratives, the cultural stories are told or enforced is more, you know, decalibrating to the human nervous system. So in the old days, the media companies that controlled the story told us the people in Guatemala are becoming communist. We have to go invade them and take their stuff. But the way that was told was a couple of people owned the newsreel companies that showed nonfiction content in the movie theater, and they told this story, and people left the theater thinking, oh, those are the bad guys. We have to do something about it. And today's media space, those stories and narratives are controlled by companies using algorithms to excite us and other companies and governments who know how to hack the business plans of social media companies in order to influence us with their bots or advertisements or targeted messaging. But the manner through which it does this isn't just a story in a movie theater. It's lots of little stories, and it's almost more of an atmospheric style of communication, where if you go on Twitter or something, no matter how you feel about the world, even if you find other people to have a conversation about something in a particular way, the environment of the platform ends up communicating to you, well, this is how the world really feels about this. So it makes us, to answer your question about the danger, it makes us more vulnerable to these totalizing ways of thinking. It makes us brittle. It makes us disoriented and longing for oversimplified, easy to follow, usually hateful ways of understanding the world. So it's a perfect recipe for, you know, authoritarianism of one sort or another.
Are people like Mark Zuckerberg basically just like the Rupert Murdochs of this digital age? Is it as easy as that? And with like more tools than he had?
It's a little different, because Rupert Murdoch or William Randolph Hearst had political beliefs. We may not have liked them, but they had ideologies. So they used their media to express their picture of the world, and their picture of the world usually benefited them financially. Mark Zuckerberg's picture of the world changes based on what he's thinking will help his company. You know, so Mark Zuckerberg is very, very afraid, right? Mark Zuckerberg believes that all of Meta could fail in 2 weeks. And because he believes his entire multi-billion dollar empire could fail in 2 weeks, he's willing to say or do whatever. So he used to pretend that he was aligned with the neoliberal left of America, the kind of Clintonian. There was the political fashion in America was to support corporations, global trade, and social justice somehow in the same breath. So he was part of that. But when Trump won the second time, he announced that he wanted to make Facebook more like Twitter, and to do more community-based evaluation of content, and to move his content moderation team from San Francisco to Austin, Texas. And for people who don't know America, that's like saying, I want to move our feminism team from Germany to Afghanistan. You know, it doesn't matter where they are. It was the announcement. It's the signifier saying, what's that saying is, and he said it in the next sentence, that he wants Meta to be more masculine, that this move to social justice has been overblown and now it's time to become more macho. What is that? You know, we could say either this is how he really feels and the rest of what he said was fake, you know, or he doesn't feel or think anything. I don't think any of them do. The closest they have to a political ideology is the one that Peter Thiel and Elon Musk grew up with, which was as, you know, wealthy white children in apartheid South Africa. These were kids who, imagine you have a two-story house and you go upstairs every night and put a gate over the staircase in case there's a revolt of black people that night and they try to come in and get you. You know, so you're raised thinking of the rest of the world as these people who will attack you, and you learn how to be comfortable by being one level up from those people. So when they look at the world and America, and if anything, see it the same way they did when they were children. So their political aspiration is for us to move into, you know, the kind of the feudalism of medieval times. You know, if you can't get off the planet, which many of them want to do, then at least realize the what's actually happening. This, the whole, you know, sort of class fluidity, let's all get along aspirations of the West or Europe are very frightening to them, because it just, as they see it, it obscures, it clouds the reality, which is that everybody hates you and wants to take your stuff. So let's just, you know, let's get honest about it. Let's build our castles and get our armies of robots and get to the social order that I remember.
What would have happened if all those tech guys would have used their power to actually stand up against Trump instead of doing that crazy knee fall we are seeing every time again and again over the last weeks and months?
Well, if the tech bros use their power to stand up against Trump, that doesn't mean they'd be standing up against Trump for us. No, they're a third and different actor. There's the humans, there's the fascists, and then there's the technocratic elite. So they weren't going to stand up for us in either way. I mean, they could have, I suppose, stood up for themselves in some way. It depends, and it's not my problem. I don't know if authoritarianism is in the best long-term interests of tech companies because of how much government can do to support innovation, for their dependence on international programmers for different kinds of innovations. You know, I feel like if these guys go with America into an increasingly isolated and authoritarian model, then, as we've always seen, countries with more openness and more thriving economies and cultures and societies will come up with better technological innovations. So I think they might be trying to lock down innovation where it is. They think this is it. But yeah, it's not a good stage when you see companies looking to spending more to maintain their monopolies than to do innovation. They're becoming more like the East India Trading Company. It's an old style chartered monopoly, not a 20th century style innovative company.
I just wrote a book called Democracy Down, and it's a fictional thriller about how you could use algorithms to destroy democracy by just shifting what becomes visible, what is getting reach and what not, and by doing that, kind of adjusting social perception and how people think and learn about what's going on in the world. How far are we from that reality in that book?
Well, we've tipped over the event horizon into that new system. We're not fully in it yet, but I feel like we're past that point. You know, we've gone over the cliff. So it's hard to get exactly the sense of it. You know, it's weird. I think a lot of people are in a thrilled feeling. I mean, some of us are afraid, but that feeling when the roller coaster goes over the top, it's like, whoa, they're not thinking about hitting the ground at the bottom yet. They've just snorted the ketamine, you know, and it's like, whoa. And I see it in the way that it's funny because I'm at this AI conference and it's making me so nauseous about AI. First, there's no such thing as AI. They haven't made AI yet, but fine. These large language models. And I feel like so many people, especially people who are in the AI industry, are getting high on their own supply. That's what we used to say about drug dealers. They're getting the positive reinforcement from the LLMs about the significance, accuracy, and truth of what they're thinking about. But this is a positive feedback loop that, as far as I can tell, and I've been wrong, I could be wrong, this has nothing to do with reality. You know, I didn't like social media back when, anyway. It really, by 1995, once the internet became the World Wide Web, I stopped liking it. It wasn't people talking anymore. It was like TV or industry, or it was being used on people. And I feel like AI or LLMs are a way to operate people that makes them feel like they're operating some piece of technology, but that it's not. It's not. It's not that the machine is thinking and powerful and taking over. It's that we're getting that dumb and disconnected.
How can we become more resilient to not kind of fall over the cliff? Or is there still a chance to kind of climb back?
I mean, there's always a chance. It almost doesn't matter whether it's going to happen or not. There's the more resilient you are and your neighborhoods are and your communities are, then the less disastrous things will be, the closer to help you will be, the sooner your recovery will be. You know, there will be other people at the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting of the civilization. So just get into the room now, you know, and find the others. Yeah, I mean, I think that the ways to resist, or the ways to foster coherence in the midst of all this, I mean, people don't like hearing them, but they're simple. It's like, make friends, have sex, go dancing, you know, hang out with children and dogs, be in nature, find ways to have to earn less money and borrow and lend more things in your neighborhoods. It's like very simple stuff that will help serve us in during climate change. It'll serve us in the wars. It'll serve you as all your friends need jobs and money and food. You know, start now. Start as soon as you can, not out of desperation. It's fun. It feels better. You have a hand to hold, even if, you know, everything's going to shit.
Do you think there could be something like ChatGPT based on democratic values? Or would that just be the boring product nobody would use?
I mean, an LLM? Sure, we could build a civic stack What do we need? What does government need? And what would that look like? A friend of mine, Marina Gorbis at Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, is talking about that. What would a public stack look like? You know, and it requires to think about it. People have to know what does public mean. In the U.S., we don't know what that means anymore. The idea of public sector, taxes, and government, that's we don't know what that is. But there's still some people that do or could be taught what that is, and then think about what do we collectively want? What would that look like? And I think it might require, for now, you know, countries each to have their own chat. What would that be like? Belgium has its chat, and Luxembourg, and everybody, Spain, you know, and indigenous people of Brazil, they each got their own data repositories.
What do you think of people like maybe also Sam Altman, who sometimes say like they are afraid of their own product or where it could lead to?
I don't really know Sam Altman, so it's hard. It's hard to judge. I never know if he's doing sales or speaking truth. You know, the way to make Chat GPT seem really, really important is to come out to the news media and say, oh my God, I just saw this Chat GPT thing. I'm so afraid. It's so powerful. It's so big. It's gonna take over the whole universe, and it's so important that we participate with it, because if it's going to be in charge of everything, don't you want your say in how it's going to be? So I never quite buy that. I think he also is probably high on his own supply. You know, he was so thrilled with number 5, you know, and now people say 5 doesn't really do stuff. Other people do say that they ask 5 things and 5 really loves them more than the other ones love them. You know, it's even better. So I don't know. I don't want to sound cynical. I know there's so much money and attention going here, but I feel like, you know, they invested so much in crypto, and the main purpose of crypto was to sell NVIDIA chips and processing power and oil and nuclear energy. And then crypto kind of failed with Sam Bankman-Fried. And how are we going to keep selling more chips and oil and nuclear? We need something. And now AI is kind of that thing. But for me, AI or LLMs, it's like, it's as revolutionary as Google was. Google was pretty big. That was a big deal that we could search the net and then build these tools on top of it. That was a big deal. It's not like the whole world, but it's a thing. And LLMs are letting us leverage the content of the internet the way we could never do before. So that's cool.
Sie haben nichts gelöscht. Sie haben nichts verboten. Sie haben einfach entschieden, was sichtbar ist. Du konntest sagen, was du willst, nur hat es niemand mehr gehört. Denn Öffentlichkeit war kein Ort mehr, sondern ein Algorithmus, ein Filter, ein System. Democracy Down ist ein Roman über das leise Ende der Demokratie. Ein Journalist erkennt, dass es nicht die Gewalt ist, die die Wahrheit auslöscht, sondern die Struktur. Was wir sehen, was wir teilen, was wir glauben. Alles ist manipulierbar. Nicht irgendwann, sondern jetzt. Democracy Down von Daniel Fürck. Ein Thriller über Sprache als Waffe und Demokratie als Opfer. Jetzt verfügbar. Überall, wo es Bücher gibt.
What does all of that mean for the future of media in the end? Because if we see more and more AI-generated content, I tend to get the feeling that it's getting more and more boring in a way, because at some point in time, we all realize, okay, that article isn't written by a human. And at some point in time, it's just getting everything kind of sounds equal. Everything is like not as exciting anymore. There is no human factor in there anymore. So are we going to see kind of a media revolution at some point in time where we actually have to think about how we want to hear, see, read about news, about things that are going on in the world?
I don't know. I mean, the entertainment and news, I mean, I still see from the old world, I still see them as different phenomena, right? That sometimes there's something about news and information that's important, even if it's not totally entertaining or fun to hear. I know that that's an old-fashioned notion, but that was the way news used to be. It was almost like a nonprofit part of a television station or radio. They had to do news. It was boring, like the BBC or something is kind of still like that. But I think for entertainment, if we want, you know, the sort of non-algorithmic, I think we're going to move to live again, live performance, and not scaled either. You know, the something more like Bali, where there's no professional musicians, but everyone's a musician and they're just playing with and for each other. I kind of like that. And the perfect stuff, the auto-tuned algorithmic things, is like, it's more like wallpaper than a painting. It's something else. I mean, we'll see. It depends how conformist we want our society to be. If we really want to move into something very authoritarian, then it might be easier not to have art, you know, because it's calling to your awareness, it's calling to your heart, you know, where you want, if we want to have kind of a very rigidly controlled population, then you can give them, what's that called, EMDR, you know, or the sort of sounds that soothe them at certain times of the day, sounds that excite them at other times, but just have AIs use Pavlovian and Skinner techniques to make sound that we think is music, but is really just programming. But otherwise, yeah, I think we're going to have to get smaller and more indie. I don't know that it would be a revolution so much as people who are willing not to make a lot of money. The same way, you know, we had the Hollywood of the 60s, the perfect verisimilitude of movies and widescreen led to 1970s indie people, you know, who were actually Spielberg and Coppola and Scorsese were the indie guys. You know, then they became big, and then we got the next wave of indie. It was like Tarantino and those guys. So there's that thing. It could happen, a new cyberpunk, you know, ethos in writing, and, you know, people making feature-length films with their smartphones and popping them up on YouTube, or, you know, we could see that.
How afraid are you by things like Stephen Colbert's show cancellation and stuff like that, like where we already see maybe at least some kind of indirect political influence?
Well, I'm not concerned about the Stephen Colbert one, because that show was actually already canceled and Paramount didn't treat him right. So he cleverly and opportunistically announced that his show had been canceled when the Trump story was happening. It gave his story legs. It was clever. And while that one in particular is not true, the larger phenomenon is true, that the Washington Post, it was a real newspaper in America, has now become, you know, a propaganda paper. CBS News under Paramount has agreed. We've seen the letters. They've agreed to become Trump-friendly. It's not comfortable for me. That's, it was one thing to have media being, subservient to commercial interests, which was a problem. I mean, it's part of how we got into the current problem, that media was, for the last 30 years, media was critical of government, but not critical of corporations. So we ended up with corporations in charge. And now media is going to not question the current regime. It's troubling. I comfort myself by saying, as I did in the beginning of our conversation, that the media has never really been trustworthy. There were these moments right after the Vietnam War where media got power and the New York Times was telling the truth, and it took down a president, and then all this investigative journalism happened. But that, as Neil Postman said, that went away. We amused ourselves to death and turned it into sensationalist crap. So in some ways, it never was. There had never been a news story that you could truly, truly trust, because there's so much, who knows? Who knows what, this happened in the Middle East or that did, and who's, I don't know. And it's hard not to just throw up my arms and say we can't know the world through that, but you can't know the world through that, which is why, to the extent that you can take actions about Israel from here, most of us in our daily lives can't or don't do much that directly impacts, the Ukraine or Middle East, but we can impact them through the way that we engage with our own communities. How dependent are you on the global supply chain? How much, it's hard for people to get, I suppose. The more invested you are in your community, the more of your resources and time and attention come from where you are, then the less stress your community is going to put on global governments, global supply chains, and global services that could be needed by those who are actually in stress.
Do you think there is like a limit in complexity human societies can actually handle? So if we look at the past decades, the world is becoming more and more complex. It's becoming more and more transparent in a way. We are seeing more and more and more. And at the same time, we are kind of losing control in a way, especially we are more and more shifting control into a certain group of people instead of doing community decisions in a way, how we want to live, how we want to shape the future, and so on.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm happy to outsource the big global decisions to someone else. In America we have 400 million people, and I've always said, what if we just task 1% of them with figuring out the big stuff? So we get, it's probably enough, 4 million people are going to work in committees on, do we give money to Israel or to Gaza? Do we, paint the sky or do we pollute the sea? Let 4 million people figure that out. And we really, it's your job. And then we don't watch news all day. We don't tweet about stuff and bother with our opinion on all that. Instead, the other 99% of us, 396 million people, really focus on each other and our communities. Where's our food coming from? Who needs help? We have all of our attention on that. And I think the world would be a better place, because I can't understand the macro issues, not because they're too complex, but because I don't actually have the information. I don't have that. And when it's commercial interests that are trying to inform me that they're not even trying to. So I think it's a mess that way. I mean, I really don't need to know. I would call me, put it this way, I'm not smart enough. I don't have the answers, you know? But if they told me, oh, but you're going to be one of the million, Doug, or one of the 4 million people who have this, okay, then what's my area? Give me an area and I'll work with another team of 40 people and we'll do just that, you know?
Well, maybe that's the superpower of the future, to actually admit that we are not capable of knowing anything and everything. Yeah. And not pretend, because right now I have the feeling that too many people pretend that they know everything and can relate to everything and can decide everything. And maybe that's the superpower to actually focus on what we really are able to do.
There are these guys out there, you know, they call them the galaxy brains, you know, these sort of, I mean, I could be accused of being one, but luckily I'm not. But these dudes who, like, they know climate change, you know, technology, you know, this and that, and Buddhism and Stoicism. It's like, oh, come on, just come off it. You're just trying to get laid like anybody else, you know? And then that's like, that's the, if you start there, rather than being afraid of it, I'm just trying to get laid like anybody else. Why is that a bad thing? I want to hug and kiss and have people and dance and, of course, you know, when you get back down to that, the world becomes so much easier. Look at these people. Look at them. They just want to spoon, you know? That's all they want.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Did you enjoy the episode? Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you prefer listening to your favorite podcast shows. Forward Thinkers is a 48 Forward podcast produced in the 48 Forward Studios in Munich.